I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Well, hello and welcome to the 500th episode of Off the Beaten Track podcast. I'm your host, Hugh Whiffin. If you're new to this podcast, well, you have joined on quite some episode. 500 episodes. Who'd have thought it, eh? Well, before we get on to today's guest, which is incredible, I've worked so hard to try and make sure we got something absolutely huge for this episode. And I mean, there's a lot of people to thank. But I mean, I've got Neil Finn. Neil Finn of Crowded House. I think Crowded House have sold 26 million records, something like that. And I presume most of yous have listened to them records, and they're fantastic. Neil Finn is an absolutely incredible songwriter. And we have a wonderful chat today. We talk about Ace Records. We talk about the new Crowded House record. We obviously talk about the journey that Neil's been on with Crowded House, and obviously Split Enz as well. We talk about that, and it's lovely. I couldn't be happier. I was so starstruck as well. I've mentioned to yous before on these episodes, like, I rarely get that starstruck. But I really, really did on this one because I'm such a fan. And so not only was it a massive, massive treat for me to get to speak to Neil, I get to then share it as a podcast as well. And I'm thrilled thrilled that I get to do that. And before we get on with that, so I want to make some thank yous. So I want to thank Scroobius Pip. If it wasn't for Pip, then I guess I wouldn't even have sort of ventured into the world of podcasting. It was kind of stumbling through episodes of the Drunk Cast with him that got me interested in doing podcasting, and it was Pip that sort of pushed to get me off of the Drunk Cast and get me to do something on my own, and Off the Beaten Track was very much part of that process. For this episode, I really want to thank Tom Dark. Tom's a lovely gentleman that has got me many guests over the years, and he's got a podcast himself. He's part of the Monkey Tennis Alan Partridge podcast. But when he reached out and said, "Look, I've got some time with Neil Finn, are you interested?" I was like, "Mate, I am such a fan. It will be incredible." Now, the new Crowded House record is not out until May, and so most of the kind of podcasts and the interviews and stuff that Neil's been doing won't be out for a long time. But I kind of pushed to make sure that I was allowed to put this one out literally a week after recording it. Less than that. I recorded that on I recorded this episode on the Monday, and it drops on the Friday. So huge thanks to Tom for sweetening the label to let me drop this chat as the 500th episode. I want to thank the team at Blue Murder Club Podcast, who have been producing this podcast for a good few years now, and that's a wonderful podcast in itself. So go check out the Blue Murder Club Podcast if you like a bit of true crime. Some other people that have been really important on the journey of this podcast today. I'm talking about it like this is the last ever episode. It's not, but 500 episodes is feels like a milestone, so I should just acknowledge a few other people as well. 76. Now, 76 is a wonderful producer that got things moving, and he still produces lots of my other podcasts that that I do, just not this one. But 76 done a big part of the early parts of getting this up and running. And I guess most of all, I should thank you lot, because from that very first nervous, shaky episode I'd done with Mr. Scroobius Pip as the first guest, I feel like I've relaxed into the podcast a little bit, and I hope that comes across. You're probably going to see me go full circle on this episode because I was so nervous to sit and chat to Neil, but once the chat gets going, I loosened up a little bit. There's been so many highlights over the 500 episodes, and yeah, I'll well, that's for you to judge. You know, you've been a long time listener, and I appreciate that support so much. And if you're not, if you've just joined to listen to my chat with Neil, then when you finish, go and explore that back catalogue, because, well, you're missing out on 499 episodes that are all there to be enjoyed for free. I'm not going to tell you anything about the Patreon today. This is all about today's episode. You can find the links to that and the links to the socials and the links to everything else on offthebeatandtrackpodcast.com or patreon.com/offthebeatandtrack. I'm just going to get on with it. Please enjoy the 500th episode of Off the Beat and Track podcast with the delightful Neil Finn.
It's Off the Beat and Track podcast on the Distraction Pieces Network. With me, Stu Whiffin.
Neil, how are you today?
I'm very well, thanks, Tom. Yeah, how are you?
Yeah, not too bad, not too bad. Where are you? You're in London at the moment, right?
Yeah, I'm in London. Yeah, I'm in a hotel room. I'm here to talk about the new record we have coming out, both the single Low High and the album's Gravity Stairs, Crowded House. About to have another crack at it.
fantastic. I mean, before we get on to the playlist, can you give me a bit of a kind of sort of snapshot as to if you're sort of sitting there on the sofa at home and how the process of like, right, we're going to make another Crowded House record. Like, what's the sort of process? Is it just like ring around the boys and go, I've got some songs, let's jump back in the studio and do it?
Well, it's not, yeah, jumping back in the studio is not quite as simple as it sounds if your band is strung out in all four corners of the globe as we are.
Yeah.
Nick Seymour, our bass player, lives in Sligo in the west coast of Ireland. Elroy, my son, who is also the drummer now in Crowded House, is living in London. My other son, Liam, lives in Los Angeles, and Mitchell Froome lives in Los Angeles, and I'm living in Auckland, New Zealand. So, yeah, that is a logistical problem. But we managed to gather for three periods of time in order to make the rhythm tracks of the record. First of all, in Byron Bay, in Australia, just before an Australian tour. Then in Bel Air in Los Angeles, just at the end of a tour. And then in Auckland, at my studio in Auckland, sort of. So those three sessions combined with a whole lot of work at home, you know, in my private space, analyzing, reworking, throwing things up in the air and rebuilding them, you know, it leads to a really, really excellent result, but it's been a long process.
Has a lot of it been done sort of remotely as well? Do you sort of obviously file share and get things?
A lot of file sharing going on. It's the modern way, and actually in ways quite good. Well, there's ups and there's positives and negatives with it. The positives are that everyone gets a chance to really try their ideas out without scrutiny and the awkwardness of studio and the clock ticking and all that. So then some of those ideas really bear fruit. They take a bit of work. They take a bit more intensity. The downside is a bit of a slow process of getting things ticked off when there's different time zones to consider, and that the process can slow down on a few occasions on that account. But you just adapt and improvise, you know.
Yeah, fantastic.
Yeah,
Neil, I'm going to kick off your playlist, and
Track one, I'm going to ask you, please, to tell me the song that you regard as having the greatest ever intro, please.
Well, the song is While My Guitar Gently Weeps, which is the Beatles, of course, and a George Harrison song in particular, and a just spectacular intro. The song itself features Eric Clapton playing guitar, so you get like a certifiable 60s guitar hero alongside the greatest band of the 60s, and you get led into this gorgeous, gorgeous song in the best possible way. And it's just a call to perfection.
Yeah, absolutely. From the early days and even looking back to the Beatles and the early days of Split Enz and Crowded House and such, the way that people would get their music then was traditionally on vinyl, and you would get played on the radio, and that was how you would get out there. And I guess in the sort of the last 10 years, we've seen the evolution of streaming services, and we're seeing these kind of pop writers that are trying to sort of cram these songs to these kind of shortening attention spans to hook people in and get on these Spotify playlists, and even, you know, things like TikTok are now becoming, you know, platforms for artists to get heard, and artists that have long since retired get kind of brought back via something going viral on TikTok. I just wonder, when you're in the studio or even when you're writing, do any of these sort of changes in how people are consuming the music filter through into your creative process at all?
It inevitably does. These things all sort of find their way of influencing you, but not in an obvious and overt way. In my case, I sort of think the process you grow up with, you adapt and improvise on top of that. And I'm always looking for a new angle every time I make a record. And there's things that won't satisfy me that were okay last time, but rather than repeat yourself, we grew up with that mentality. And I embrace modern technology as much as I can. A little bit of knowledge is a dangerous thing, they say, and I really adhere to that concept. Yeah. Trying to do too much, and also trying to be one of the kids is pretty hopeless as well. Trying to predict what might take off on TikTok, I don't know if any of the things that have happened in any meaningful way have been decided on by artists or record companies. The most significant ones seem to happen by chance, and so it's best not to try and predict or play the game, as it were, and just keep doing really good work in the best way you possibly can. And we'll use modern technology, and back in the day we embraced synthesizers and willingly, and but guitars and synthesizers still have their place, and now there's all sorts of other machines and song making equipment that I haven't yet ventured into because I don't see the need. But the basic pulling ideas out of thin air is still just as mysterious and challenging and actually wonderful when it comes off.
Absolutely. For track two, I'm going to take you back, and I'm going to ask you to tell me the first song you remember hearing that had an emotional impact on you, please, Neil.
Yeah, well, it was a song by the New Christy Minstrels, Green, Green, the Grass is Green on the Far Side of the Hill. Da, da, da. There were other songs around. We had singles, and we had a record player when we were kids, and that was just one song that ended up on the turntable a lot for some reason. And weird things affect you in different ways. So that one just had a kind of a sense of some exotic place that I couldn't put my finger on. As it turned out, I think it was an American sort of sounding record, a little bit in that folk, the folk tradition. But I didn't know where it was coming from. I had no idea. It just had a feeling of other places and a kind of harmony, a real intense harmony strength, folk kind of basis to it. But when I was 4 years old, it resonated for me for some reason. Still goes around in my head sometimes when I'm in the shower.
If you had to pinpoint the emotion, what would that have been?
The emotion? Oh, it was certain freedom attached to it. Grass is greener on the other side, a kind of feeling, like something's going on out there. Even as a 4 or 5 year old, I was thinking, wow, this is a world's not like, not just what's happening out in my front yard. There's something else going on out there, so a sort of a wonder, sense of wonder.
Yeah. You mentioned singles then. Give me a sort of an insight into what home was like growing up. Was it a musical place?
Yeah, there was always music around. We had a piano, and my mum played the piano by ear a little bit. Every party my parents had always had singing. They were always singing, standing around a piano, singing the popular songs. Everyone had their item, the same. They'd sing the same one every party, you know, and nobody got sick of it.
Yeah.
My auntie would sing Stormy Weather. My uncle would sing Shake Hands with a Millionaire. It seemed like part of a natural gathering of people is to sing. So, yeah, I feel lucky. I mean, it happened a lot in those days. Maybe it still happens. Maybe people are a little more distracted now, but I think it's still quite special.
Yeah. You mentioned there was a piano in the house, having instruments about. Was that something that you was actively encouraged to do? Because a lot of kids kind of kick against their parents when they're kind of, you know, had these things sort of thrust upon them. Or was it something that you just gravitated to?
We gravitated towards it. My brother and I, he was 5 years older than me. I wanted to do everything he was doing, and he was learning how to play piano. And so I wanted to learn, and we, you know, pretty soon realized that I had a reasonable voice, so I could sing in tune, and, you know, it was kind of cool that not many people could, which made me feel good.
Yeah.
And we could harmonize together, my brother and I, and we got hauled out in front of our parents' friends to sing little songs. And yeah, I didn't need much encouragement, but my parents certainly were very encouraging. They were delighted to see that their sons were, you know, quite good at music, and you know, it was a lot of entertainment value for them.
Yeah, absolutely.
In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com to get 5% off your first purchase with code REBAGNEW. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAGNEW for 5% off your first purchase.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Stay in the formative years, and I'm going to ask you to tell me the name of the song that reminds you of your time at school, please, Neil.
The song Homeward Bound by Simon and Garfunkel reminds me particularly of a journey. My brother was at boarding school in Auckland at Sacred Heart, and I eventually went there too. But when we were visiting him on free Sundays, as they call them, for some reason that song, I must have heard it once going over the hill that leads into Auckland, and it just had a really powerful, evocative feeling to me of expanding. You know, again, I guess I was thinking about other, you know, the song is a melancholy song about wanting to go home and being on the road, and that mix of emotions of, you know, the big wide world out there, but you know, the call or the drag of home or whatever. But yeah, it just still has that effect. It takes me back to that exact moment, and my, you know, I was probably 7 or 8 at the time, so that was my school days song. Yeah,
it's got a beautiful sense of wonder, hasn't it? That song is pretty perfect.
I mean, he wrote some exquisite songs at the time, and that one had a deep atmosphere, and the other one I loved was, you know, Only Living Boy in New York.
Oh, God, yeah. What a record.
It's got so much atmosphere and so evocative of the time, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Did you enjoy school?
By and large, yeah. I enjoyed school. I didn't, I was, you know, good enough at lessons that I did okay. And, you know, we had a lot of fun. We had pretty good school. I think there was a couple of teachers who were, you know, bordering on sadists. But, you know, you get away from that, look back, it's kind of funny more than anything else. As long as you get, you know, you escape their clutches more often than not.
Yeah.
But I was in an era at secondary school where they were still caning kids. And, you know, it was a bit of a badge of honor. You know, I got caned. I got six on the ass by a brother, and my whole ass went black and blue for about 3 weeks. And, you know, that was child abuse, really. But, I didn't like it at the time, but it didn't seem to throw me off.
Did you know what you wanted to be?
Yeah, I decided I wanted to be a musician when I was about 12 years old. And, I didn't really have any deviations from that. It seemed accessible, and I already learned enough to, you know, to feel like I could write songs and, you know, make a go of it.
In the area that you grew up in, you know, did it seem like it was, you know, possible to make it and to make a career in music? And like, and if so, like, who were the sort of inspirations?
Well, it was unprecedented that a New Zealand musician could make it internationally. I don't think really anybody had, except maybe Kiri Te Carnarvon, on an opera stage. I don't know what we were basing it on, but we had some feelings of being able to take on the world. My brother's band, Split Ends, when they started, had a very, you know, they were very ambitious, very willful and reactionary. And there was something about that had a sense of magic about it and wonder for me that I sort of thought, maybe it's possible, you know, to get out there and do what all those bands we loved. You'd do the same thing, and there was a dream, definitely a dream forming.
When you look back on them early tours, and when it's kind of all to be played for, do you look back really fondly on them times?
Oh yeah, there was amazing memories of being in Split Ends when I first joined. I was only 18 years old and coming to England for the first time. It was a mixture of things, because some of the gloss of those deeply romantic held views from far away of, you know, places like the Marquee Club as being some glamorous kind of place, and finding the carpet all sticky and it stinking of cigarettes and human detritus, and, you know, like, but so there was a mixture of things. But, you know, overall it was a glorious time, and I was really lucky to be in my brother's band, you know, at the age of 18, and having that experience. You know, really, I probably short-circuited quite a bit of paying my dues in that regard. So I've got to be grateful for that.
And to be finding yourself overseas, you know, playing in a band at such a young age, were you a confident young man?
Yeah, I'm confident enough. I wasn't a confident guitar player, and certainly aware of my own limitations. And for the first 6 months, there may have been a couple of members of the band who were questioning the logic of having me in there. When I was clearly a little, you know, pretty remedial on the electric guitar, but I could sing, and I knew that I sounded, you know, I was doing the job as a singer, and they believed in me. So I guess in hindsight, I was definitely confident enough to get out there. I didn't suffer from paralytic nerves or anything.
Yeah, and I mean, sort of moving forwards to, you know, and even the huge show in Sydney, the farewell show in the mid to late 90s. Like, I mean, does confidence get you through stuff like that, when you know you're going to walk out in front of a crowd like that, which very, very few people have ever experienced, that level of attention being on stage, and obviously you being at the front, the focus is, you know, predominantly on you. Like, how do you deal with that?
There's an element of apprehension going on stage. I haven't really ever suffered from terrible stage fright or nerves. You know, like, there's people I know that'll throw up before a show. I haven't really had that kind of level of anxiety, but definite apprehension. You want it to go really well. And the main thing that I always try and, well, in that particular show especially, just focus on playing as well as we possibly could, and really listening to each other and engaging each other, you know, which means eye contact on stage. It's really important. And trusting each other, and just really listening, and not getting too drawn into crowd watching. I mean, it was incomprehensible, the amount of people anyway at that show. And the scene was so spectacular. It was glorious to observe, but I didn't really want to get too, you know, we just concentrated on each other and really playing as well as we could, doing the right thing by the songs.
I wore out my VHS copy of that, Neil. It was a wonderful, wonderful thing to watch. And not just for your performance. I don't know if you recall, but there was guys in the crowd throwing each other like 20 foot in the air.
It was incredibly difficult for some of the fans who'd been camped out all day. I didn't realize till later what a hardship it was to be stuck there, because the crowd was much larger than anybody anticipated, and it would have been very hard to get out once you were there. So, you know, all sorts of weird realizations that, I mean, how are people going to go? How are they going to go to the bathroom? You know,
don't ask that question.
Slight and slender young girls that were getting, you know, knocked around by big bruising guys moshing at the front. And I felt for them, and luckily nobody got hurt, you know, but it was a miracle, really.
Yeah, it was a beautiful event. Can you tell me, please, the first song you remember buying from a record store, please, Neil?
Well, the first record I ever bought was a Donovan record, actually, called Fairy Tale. And I don't know why. I was learning how to play electric acoustic guitar at the time and learning folk music, actually, specifically, because that was the only guitar teacher that was in town. It was an accident, really, but I liked it. Learning how to finger pick, the claw hammer and things like that. And I think I heard Donovan, and he was obviously an exponent of that kind of finger pick guitar. So I got it in order to study that. And it has a very evocative feeling for me to hear it, that record now. And amongst other things, which were, very classic Donovan folky kind of things, like Candyman, I think was one of the songs. There's a song on there called Sunny Good Street, which is really unusual and kind of sort of jazz, like a slightly musical jazzy kind of vibe to it. And of course, I'm in London now, staying just up the road from Good Street. So it always reminds me of, it reminded me then when I'd never been to London of London, yeah. but it certainly does even more so.
Oh, wonderful. Were record shops important places for you growing up?
Yeah, they were, because they were the only place you could really go to get music. I gathered quite a few records around me. My brother would bring me records from Auckland. He introduced me to a lot of music, and he was in university at the time and starting off Split Ends, and he brought home Led Zeppelin II, Roxy Music, some David Bowie records, Carole King, Tapestry, various records that he gifted me that were quite pivotal at the time. I remember with the Led Zeppelin record, I put the speakers of our stereo facing inwards, like headphones and a pillow in between them, and that's how I discovered Led Zeppelin. It was pretty mighty, actually. It was quite loud and very all-consuming and immersive, you know. So that knocked me out.
I asked you about confidence.
Why don't more infant formula companies use organic, grass-fed whole milk instead of skim? Why don't more infant formula companies use the latest breast milk science? Why don't more infant formula companies run their own clinical trials? Why don't more infant formula companies use more of the proteins found in breast milk? Why don't more infant formula companies have their own factories instead of outsourcing their manufacturing? We wondered the same thing. So we made ByHeart, a better formula for formula. Learn more at ByHeart.com.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices.
Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
As a young man, in regards to sort of taking to the stage on them early tours, and confidence aside, I want to ask a little bit about drive and what drives your creativity. You know, to this day, where does that drive come from to make another Crowded House record or to make another Nin Fin record?
Well, it is compulsive, and it's probably even more so than ever. And there's a certain stubbornness about, because there's a lot of times we sit down to write something and what comes out is quite banal, and you know, you question whether you might have seen, you know, your best ideas. And then there's a stubbornness kicks in and say, no. I mean, if I keep on this and I turn up every day, something good will emerge. And it always does.
Yeah.
And that's the fascination of it, really. There's no real necessarily a rule for when it's going to turn up or how it's going to turn up. You just keep yourself interested and kind of get playful with it again, like a child, and then use the best editing instincts of an adult to figure out the good stuff and dispense with the bad stuff. And then, you know, working out how to make it, to finish it off is a really fascinating process. And there's always the reward and the, you know, that if you go through that difficult birthing process and have those flashes of inspiration, but then prepared to put the work in to make something really beautiful that's fashioned and ordered, and then you get the big payoff both in front of an audience and the idea that somebody will come up to you at some point and say, and sometimes it's songs that aren't the ones that everybody loves, come up and say, I really bonded with a song of yours, which was a, you know, B-side on some record, and it really helped me through a difficult time. And then you just go, wow, fantastic. What a useful thing, alongside it being intensely rewarding to come up with that on a personal level. There actually does seem a purpose to it, which is a bigger purpose and you know, worth the struggle. So that's a compelling thing. I can't think of anything else other than digging my hands in the soil and growing things that is as elemental as that, you know.
For track 5, I'm going to ask you to tell me the song that soundtracked your years clubbing.
I wasn't a big clubber, actually, to be honest. But I noticed on the question you asked it, you made a point of saying it doesn't have to be at a nightclub. I would associate my years of going to parties and more late school era. And it occurred to me that one record that was an absolute dead cert for every party we went to anyway was Cocker Happy, the Joe Cocker record. It just was a really big record in that era. And for some reason, the song that really resonated for me on that record, it's a great record, but was Marjorie, which is an unusual song. It was probably the strangest song on the record, but it really had me for some reason. And so that I really, when I hear that song now, I really associate it with, you know, joyous nights, but with slightly painful overtones if I fancied somebody and they went off with somebody else, you know, those kind of echoes of unrequited love.
That's where the songs come from, Neil, right?
Right, yeah. Right. That's partying is always, it's got the duality about it usually, hasn't it?
Before I ask for your track, I just want to know about them kind of, because I'm going to take you home for this one. It is the track regarding your home county, but in those early sort of formative years of playing, can you sort of also tell me a little bit about the sort of scenes that were going on, and like, what was it, a healthy band scene, and was there sort of competitiveness within that, or was it, you know, or was there a real good community within it? Because I'm always fascinated by them kind of, sort of scenes where bands kind of break from.
Well, actually, to be honest, where I grew up in Te Awamutu, in the Waikato in New Zealand, there was really hardly any bands at all. There were bands, but they were playing at pubs, and they were just, I wasn't going to pubs at the time when I grew up, obviously. So I didn't get to see many bands. There was a band called Mandrake, who had a fella called Chris Thompson. We ended up in Manfred Mann singing Blinding by the Light, and he wrote a few songs, notable songs.
Yeah.
other people as well, but he was in that band, and I never got to see them, but I became aware that they were, you know, they were sort of popular in the area, but I can't really point to a scene that I was aware of. There was a scene of folk clubs. I used to go to folk club because it was the only place I knew of that people were playing music, and it wasn't that I was particularly a folky. I wasn't attracted to, you know, Celtic songs or whatever in the first instance. I became aware of them as a result of going to those. I was more like, you know, playing Cat Stevens songs, Neil Young songs, and they kind of fitted, you know, in there. I could do those, and people accepted those as a you know, from a young fella who didn't know any better. But when I got to Auckland, I was only there for about a year in Auckland before I got called to join Split Enz. And Split Enz had a very singular vision and didn't really feel part of any kind of scene. Most of the bands around at that time in Auckland were sort of playing boogie or you know, blues music or psychedelic, or, you know, there was definite genres going on that, and Split Enz had a very different mindset about who they related to, and it was definitely people mostly coming out of the UK at the time, you know, Roxy Music. Actually, they were big fans of Lindisfarne in the early stages. There was something about the way that they sang that is reminiscent of the way Tim and Phil sang on the early Split Enz records. That hard northern kind of really beautiful but really hard kind of harmony singing that Lindisfarne did. And also, you know, bands like the Lars were really good at, you know, that it's really sweet but it's real hard edged as well. It's got a duality about it.
Absolutely. And I mean, even, you know, the UK, you know, jumped all over Split Enz, and obviously have very much adore what you've done with Crowded House. Tell us a little bit about, you know, your relationship with the UK.
Well, I came over to join my brother's band in the UK in 1977, and so I had quite a long year and a half living here, and you know, I've got golden memories of the time, even though we were broke most of it, and we were dropped by a label, and things didn't go that well for us at the end of that. We had an audience initially, and we still had a live audience, but, you know, we hadn't made that transition up to a level of success. But, you know, it didn't matter to me. I was just young. I was having a really fine time living. And Noel Crombie, who was the kind of band, he was a percussionist and designed the costumes. And he and I lived in Chorley Wood, just north of London. And we had the best address I've ever had, number one Apple Tree Dell, Dog Kennel Lane, Chorley Wood, which was enough for me. That was good enough. We really grew as a band in that time, and there's some urgency to living to the way that music, good music comes out of the UK in part, I think, because it's a grim, there's a long winter, you got to make your own beauty, you got to make your own sunshine, and there's a lot of grim places to be, and there again, people make their own beauty, and they, you know, and the humor and the grit that comes out of those experiences is the kind of foundation of a lot of amazing music here, I think.
Absolutely.
You know, it's harder for people to make great music in beautiful tropical climates, I think, because they're, having said that, I mean, they didn't do too badly in Jamaica, but, you know, like, there's something about those slightly grim conditions, but it gives you a sense of urgency, and we certainly had urgency in that time. We wanted to push on through and find ourselves as a band, so the UK gave us some of that, I think.
Lovely. This is your last track, Neil, and I'm going to ask you to tell me and the listeners a song that you think many of us may not know that you would like us to hear, please.
Well, this, you may have to dig around a little bit to find this, but it's a song called The Lighthouse Keeper, and it's from a series called that was a requiem. A friend of mine in New Zealand, Victoria Kelly, wrote it. It actually got played on BBC Three when it got released, and so you can find it, but it's the most extraordinary piece of music that makes me cry when I hear it. This guy, Simon O'Neill, that sings it, he's a tenor, quite a successful opera singer in New Zealand, but she put this right up at the very top of his range, and so he sings it. It sounds like you can't tell if it's a woman or a man singing it. It's just really emotional, and it's not coming from a pop idiom, but it's accessible. It's not going to make anyone run and hide. It's actually really involving and beautiful piece of music, so giving it a plug right now.
Well, we can ensure that people get to listen to that and all the other songs that we've spoken about today, and we put together a little Spotify playlist to accompany the podcast.
Oh, there we go. All right.
And on that as well, we'll obviously have the new single, and obviously some of your past works. And
yeah, great.
So the new album, I mean, we're recording this in February. The new album's not out just yet, right?
That's out May.
For a while. May, yeah.
Yeah.
And I mean, I believe there is a little show tomorrow, which I'm hopefully going to pop up at. And
all right, you know about the little gathering at BMG.
Yeah.
All right. Well, we'll see you there.
So absolutely, but for the wider masses, when are they going to get to see Crowded House do their thing?
Well, we've got a tour that's already virtually sold out, I think, but it's we're playing a series of castles in the UK, and you know can't get to do that anywhere else in the world. But we're outside a whole bunch of castles, some beautiful locations, through June, and I think there's one forest, the Wasing Park Forest or something. And then we're coming back in, it's not even been announced yet, but I think we're coming back in September to do some shows.
Fantastic. And if people want to keep up to speed with all things Crowded House, straight to the website?
Yeah, we've got a website, and we've got, I'm not on social media, but I know we have an active social media presence.
Fantastic. Neil, thank you so much for giving up your time today at Talk Records with me, mate. It's been an absolute pleasure, mate.
All right, mate.
Thank you so much. I'll see you tomorrow.
All right. See ya.
Thank you.
Bye.
Well, there you go. 500 episodes completed it. Neil Finn. Ah, what a lovely, lovely man. It was so nice. Thanks hugely to Tom for helping get this one over the line. I hope you enjoyed it. Any new listeners that jumped on that are huge Crowded House fans, I hope you learned a little bit more about Neil and his influences and some of the songs that soundtracked his life to date. Go check out that new record. Go check out the back catalogue of this podcast. I'm just quite overcome with it all at the moment because it was just so nice to get to chat to a hero. Yeah. 500. It's ridiculous. Anyway, onwards to 1,000. Thanks so much for listening. I love doing this, and I love that you lot listen and get joy from it. And yeah, share this one about and nudge your mates and tell them that there's this guy from Essex with a lisp that gets overexcited talking to musicians and DJs and producers and comedians and actors I'm done. I've run out of things to say. I'm never lost for words, but I am. Thanks ever so much for all of your support. Love you lots. I'll see you next time. Bye-bye.